My castaway this week is a producer. He comes from a Scottish Jewish family, and after a cosmopolitan but unhappy childhood when he was educated in Switzerland, Germany and France, ended up working in the London theatre. The first show he produced was a complete flop. Undaunted, he tried again, and the string of successes he's since enjoyed testify to the wisdom of that decision. Sleuth, O Calcutta, A Chorus Line, The Rocky Horror Show, to name a tiny few. Famous not just for his theatrical flair, but his lifestyle too. Beautiful women always accompany him on his frequent trips to London clubs and parties. He can't think of one good thing about growing old. Now 60, he still loves every minute of his job. It's like being on a roller coaster, he says.
He is Michael White. A roller coaster with no guarantee of coming up the other side, though, Michael. I mean, you must have made and lost a fortune in your time, if not several.
Several. It's an extremely risky business, and it becomes more so because the one thing that's happened is that the public now expect productions to have such enormous quality in the scenic lighting, sound departments. And obviously that's extremely expensive.
And there's no such thing as a surefire hit. That's the problem, isn't it? You can put a lot of money into something that goes fut on the first night.
Well, yes, there are many famous occasions of shows that have opened with tremendous advance and expectation, and they just don't happen. I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, of a musical I did called Charlie with Michael Crawford when he was at the height of his fame. He loved the show. It was a good show, but the public just did not want to come and see it.
But what is it? So there's no rhyme or reason to it, are you
saying? Correct. There's absolutely no rhyme or reason.
It's not that the critics do for it?
No. The critics give an indication. When the critics are extremely bad, there's no way a show can survive unless it's got something very special. But when the critics are mixed, for instance, like on a show like Les Miserables, the critics were very divided, but the public liked it. Mm. And that grew and grew and grew, and it's, for instance, become one of the biggest hits of all time.
Not one of yours?
Not one of mine, no.
Crazy
but one
for you,
I like.
Crazy for You has been one of yours. Mm-hmm. It's just finished. What sort of money are we talking about for a big, high-stepping musical like that, Gershwin music and so on? What's the investment?
Well, the investment was £3 million. £1 million went on the scenery. The costumes, I think, were just under £600,000. And then you add everything else, you know, the shoes, the rehearsal time, the props, the lighting, the advertising.
£3 million up front.
To get to opening night.
But how long before a show like that, Crazy for You, starts to, as they say in the business, wash its own face, you know, start bringing in some money, making
some
money?
Well, that took nearly a year and a half to get back the money.
To get back the money,
yes.
And then after that it's profit?
Yes.
You've put on about 25 musicals in your time. How many have been flops?
I would have thought serious flops, about 3 or 4.
Hmm. And how much of your own money is riding on these days? Have you learned a long time ago not to put your own money in there?
No, I have learned, but I still do it, because sometimes out of necessity, when you can't raise the money, and sometimes you just do. I mean, I've spent a lot of money, not so much on theatre, but on developing films that for one reason or another don't happen. And then you're left having spent maybe £100,000 or £200,000.
But that's the gamble, that's the roller coaster.
Correct.
That's what you love.
Well, yes.
With reservations, I see. We shall talk about those. Tell me about your first record.
Well, it was very difficult to think of a show record to play, since there's so many I've done, so many I like. And then I thought, well, all the shows I've done I can do myself. I can sing to myself on this island. So I think I'll pick one, which when I saw it, just the song knocked me out, and the whole production. It was Jerome Robbins' West Side Story.
I like to be in America, okay by me in America, everything free in America, for a small fee in America.
America. I like the city of San Juan,
I know a boat you can get on.
Hundreds of flowers in full bloom,
hundreds of people in each room.
Automobile in America, chromium sea in America.
America, from the original cast recording of West Side Story. The problem for theatrical producers, Michael White, is that people always like to hear about their flops, I suppose, rather more than their successes. Here we go, just with one, and I promise we'll talk about some successes later. But presumably your biggest was a show that was never seen 13 years ago, something called I, in lowercase. What was it and why did we never see it?
You didn't see it because when I saw the dress rehearsal, I knew the result. I mean, you do often know. You pray that you'll get away with it, but deep down you know when something's good or bad, and you know it pretty quickly. And after I'd sat through the rehearsal, I just knew what would happen. I knew we'd get trashed, demolished and pilloried.
But why? What was going wrong?
It didn't work. It had, like many things, it had wonderful elements. Like the leading man, Arturo Brichetti, was extraordinary and very gifted.
He's a mime artist.
Yes. And beautiful to watch. But the show didn't hang together.
But it was revolutionary in that you'd pulled out all the seats in this theatre, hadn't you?
Yes, we were going to make it into a sort of sophisticated version of a dinner theatre. And I think we made two mistakes. First of all, we tried to do dinner when it should have just been like tapas snacks. And secondly, the show was incredibly ambitious, too ambitious for the theatre and too expensive. On the evening, we were meant to have a charity preview, first major public viewing, and the royalty were coming. And at the end of the show, I said to the director and the actors, we just cannot open with this.
But how do you feel in that moment?
Do you feel, I suppose, the way a general feels when he's just lost a major battle and the troops are advancing on your hometown?
But if you look at the range of things you did, you know, from O Calcutta to Joe Orton's entertaining Mr Sloan, to Barry Humphries as Dame Edna, and then some Ibsen and some GBS thrown in. You know, it's an eclectic bunch. What does it have in common? I mean, is it just that it's all your taste, all things you wanted to do in that moment?
Well, I don't know. It's partly my taste. I have schizophrenic taste in the sense that I like the mainstream, what I call the Ethel Merman school of show business, which is, I thought she was the greatest, and that kind of, it's show business, etc. But I also very much like the avant-garde and the new and the unexpected. And when I brought people over like Merce Cunningham and John Cage and Pina Bausch for the first time to London, and lots of American dancers, the Living Theatre and people like that, they were very extreme at the time, more than the shows you sort of mentioned.
So you've never done anything cynically? You've never thought, well, I don't think much of it, but the punters will like it?
I did once. It was a light, frothy Broadway comedy. It wasn't bad.
Called?
Any Wednesday. It was a little fluffy play, and I didn't particularly think it was that good, but I thought it would do very well on Shaftesbury Avenue. Unfortunately, I was wrong.
But you've got to believe in what you're putting on.
Yes, really, but I would say that's the only show I've done ever that I didn't really believe in, but I thought it'll make a few bob, and I need to make a few bob at the moment, and let's do it.
Record number two.
But this record just reminds me of my childhood in a kind of nice way. It ties in with remembering a bit the way my mother was. And my mother was, when I was a child, rather very jolly and warm and liked dance very much. Took me to a lot of ballet and liked dancing around. And the song just reminds me about those days and her.
Tangerine, she is all they claim. With her eyes of night and lips as bright as flame. Tangerine, when she dances by, senorita stare and caballero sigh.
Benny Goodman and his orchestra and Tangerine and memories of your mother, Michael White. You were born in Glasgow.
Yes, I was, but I was just born there because, in fact, my father was from Dublin, and my mother was of Russian descent. My grandparents were Russian.
And there's some Irish in there as well.
Yes, on my father's side. So it's a very nice mix, and I just was in Russian. I felt the Russian bit in me coming out.
But it was a childhood described in some of the profiles as being miserable. What was miserable about it?
Well, it was miserable because I had very acute asthma. So that's why I don't like going on about it, just brings back bad memories. That's the only reason. I was very sickly.
But it's also been said in these profiles I've read that that was a psychosomatic illness, you said.
It could be.
For what reason? Can you explain?
I don't know. I don't know. I've never tried to find out, and I think it's better not to try and find out why. I mean, it's clear that asthma is both physical and psychosomatic. But the thing is, I suffered from it extremely badly. I was bedridden.
Is that why you were sent away to school to Europe?
Yes, that's why I went to Switzerland. I went to Switzerland when I was just 7, and it was quite difficult.
By yourself?
Yes. To a school where none of the other boys spoke English. And so I learnt French pretty quick. Had to.
But that's why you would describe your childhood as miserable, isn't it?
I mean,
yes,
you landed
out
miserable.
There not being able to speak any language without your parents, without your family.
Correct.
It was quite a cruel thing to do to you, wasn't it?
Well, it was and it wasn't. It was a choice between being ill in Britain or trying to get better in Switzerland.
But you must have been terribly lonely.
Oh, I was, yes, very. And then just as I learnt French fluently, obviously, because when you're a child, the doctor said, oh, Michael should go higher up, so I was moved to German-speaking Switzerland. And then I had to start all over again learning German and Italian, but particularly German, which is quite difficult. By this time I was nearly 10. And that was a much tougher school. It was run like an English public school. It's still there. It's a very famous school near St. Moritz. So I had some virtues. Skiing.
Mm.
Very good food by school standards. But quite miserable as well.
And did the family visit?
Yes, but not that much.
And did you come home at all, or was that not a sensible idea?
There were some times I didn't come home and stayed there on the holidays, and sometimes I did. But this is all sounding sadder than it actually is. Now, it was quite lonely, but it also had its good side. It made me very open-minded. By the time I was 12, I spoke all these languages. I had a very open, cultural, different attitude to things than most people.
And when did you develop a love or a liking for, anyway, the theatre? When did you decide that that was what you wanted to do with yourself, with your life?
Oh, much, much later. Just by accident, I got a summer job helping this woman, this famous producer who had a summer theatre.
But eventually you came to this country, you came to London, and you went to work for the impresario, Sir Peter Daubney. What did you do for him?
Peter specialised in doing international theatre seasons. And when I was with him, it was an extraordinary time of being involved with the Berlin Ensemble, the Moscow Arts Theatre, the Comédie Française. It was all very, very exciting.
And so your education obviously stood you in good stead for all of that.
Yes,
extremely adept at rushing around Europe, talent-spotting these shows.
It was a real compliment. I was in the hotel lobby in Paris talking to the French Minister of Culture. I couldn't have been more than 23 at the time. I was trying to persuade him why something should happen in French. And at the end of the conversation, the phone lady in this hotel, who was on these nice French concierge types, said, oh, you really did that well. You really perform well. And I admire what you said to him. So I thought, well, all those years came in handy.
And then you learned that you didn't want to go on being somebody's right-hand man, but that you wanted to be a producer in your own right. But we'll pause in your story for the next piece of music.
Which is a sad song, Billie Holiday, I Cover the Waterfront.
Will the one I love be coming back to me? I cover the waterfront.
Billie Holiday and I Cover the Waterfront. So you went out on your own, Michael, in the early 60s. You produced a show called The Connection and guess what? It fell flat on its face. What was wrong? What went wrong with it?
Well, it's quite simple what went wrong. It was a show done by the Living Theatre in New York in a very naturalistic way, i.e. it was set in a loft. It was about some drug addicts waiting for the connection to come. And by doing it in a West End Edwardian theatre It had completely the wrong feel to it. There are shows that don't feel right in certain theatres.
And you think that conveys itself to the audience and can...
Yes, I do.
And can lead to the show not working.
Yes, there are all kinds of things. When you go into a show that's a hit, into the where you get your tickets or meet your friends, there's a buzz in the air. People want to be there. When you go to a show that isn't successful, it's very, very calm. It's kind of... It's all kinds of little things like that that tell you what's right and wrong.
Where do you stand? Where are you on your opening nights?
Oh, I like hiding.
Where do you
really
hide?
Well, the worst one was when I hid in a broom cupboard by mistake and then couldn't get out. But I like standing at the back. Or sometimes if I feel very brave, I used to sit near the critics, but I don't do that anymore. It's too nerve-wracking.
And at what point do you know? I mean, obviously, at the first night, there's that buzz in the foyer that you describe of anticipation. At what point in the show do you think, this is it, got the hit? When do you know?
You just feel it. You just feel that you've won over the audience or that you've lost them. And once you've lost them, it's very hard to get them back. And then unexpected things can happen. I remember going to the first night of a show that wasn't my show. Well, I can tell you which show it was. It was Starlight Express, and it was not going that well. And then the leading man fluffed something and said something, and the audience warmed towards him. And in that split 10 seconds, the mood changed, and then it all went terrifically.
So he had the sympathy of the audience.
Correct.
Suddenly they wanted him...
They wanted him to win. Sometimes there are first nights that are just fantastic from the moment the curtain goes up. Chorus Line was one. And then there are first nights where you just want to crawl away and really hide. You don't want to see any human being. You can't. You don't know what to say or do. You don't want to kill yourself, but you emotionally are completely dead. It's a combination of having lost a lot of money, done something that doesn't work, disappointed everyone. It's a horrible feeling.
Record number 4.
Oh, this is The Platters and Only You.
Tell me why.
It's for all the girls.
Only you can make all this world seem right.
Platters and Only You. You can't interview Michael White and not talk about his reputation with women. It's said that you've cultivated a semi-playboy image, and I say semi because you work rather hard at the same time. Is that fair?
Yes, that's not unfair.
Why?
I don't think there's anything wrong with being a playboy.
But it's important to you to have a beautiful woman on your arm, is it?
No, it's not important. It's just nicer than having a less beautiful one. I think beautiful women are very... They're like, you know, people go to museums to look at pictures. They're like living pictures.
Some people would say that's a very sexist remark, of course.
It works on both ways. I feel that I can feel the same way about looking at a very good-looking man. I mean, it's a fact that it's an extraordinary thing. It's like, it is like paintings. And there is this politically correct thing that nobody should look good, but it's just, it doesn't work that way.
So it just gives you pleasure to have a beautiful woman on your arm, and preferably a young one?
Yes, in the sense that younger people look better than older people, although there are exceptions, a lot of exceptions. I mean, some people can age absolutely wonderfully. It's to do with inner spirit as well, with character. There is no such thing as a beautiful person unless they have something inside as well.
But has all of that image that you have got anything to do with your own ageing? It's you fighting against the ageing process,
possibly,
is it?
But I've always been like that.
And have you always not liked getting older?
Always, yeah. I'd be quite happy to have stayed a teenager forever.
Wouldn't we all?
Exactly. So you're agreeing with me.
I'm agreeing with you, but I'm just asking you because it's quite interesting.
I just think most people say things because it's the correct thing to say. Like, oh, yes, growing older gives me wisdom. I know more about this, I understand more, or I'm more tolerant. And it's just not true. People become less tolerant. They become very set in their ways. This is the thing I think one has to fight against. And that's why I like going to clubs and I like hanging out with young people, because it stops you being so, I can only do it one way, this way, and if you don't do it that way, it's wrong.
But what is extraordinary about that is that at the age of 60, you still have the energy to work as hard as you do and to be out raving or clubbing, you know, into the early hours of the morning. How do you do it?
I suppose I'm lucky in that sense, and I also like the kind of music that's happening at the moment, which is a lot of people don't like.
Do you have any desire for stability and continuity in your life, or do you quite like being
on the hoof, no desire for stability at all. Don't like routine.
No.
You'll get that when you're dead. You'll have lots of stability. You'll be stuck in one place forever. So I think while you're alive, you have to live.
Next piece of music.
Well, I was just in Mexico with my friend Jean Pigozzi, and we went to this club, and I saw something I've never seen before, which was the guy who ran the club got the entire audience and 500 people up in rows doing this dance. It was the most impressive bit of showmanship. And I wanted to pick this record because it was a fun thing and it's very good to dance to for exercise on the island. And it's Los Del Rio doing the Macarena.
When I dance, they call me Macarena. And the boys, they say que soy buena. They all want me. So they all come and dance beside me. Move with me, chant with me. And if you're good, I'll take you home with me.
Alegría Macarena, que tu cuerpo es para dar la alegría y cosas buenas. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría Macarena, Macarena. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría Macarena, que tu cuerpo es para dar la alegría.
Los Del Rio and Macarena. We've talked about the costs of putting on a big show, Michael, but not exactly about the finances. What's the rule of thumb, re the box office takings? Who gets which third and what?
Well, generally speaking, the theatre takes about 30% of the box office to cover the cost of the theatre, the rent, the staff, the electricity. And then I suppose another 20 to 30% goes on all the other costs. So you're left with that margin. Most big shows now would cost 50 to 60% of the potential box office take. Mm.
So you, as the producer, are controlling, as it were, two-thirds of the box office takings, roughly speaking.
Yes.
But what have you got to do with that? You've got to
pay everybody you see on stage. And for everyone on stage, there's probably two people backstage. So you have to pay them, you have to pay the author, the composer, the musicians, you have to pay everything.
You need, therefore, to have these backers. They used to call them angels, I don't know whether you still do.
Yes, we still call them that. They're rarer.
Rarer in the sense that they were the people, as I recall it, were around in the boom times when people liked to dabble in theatre, didn't mind if
Correct.
They lost a bob or two. Who's doing that kind of thing these days?
Well, unfortunately, it's much harder, much, much harder to get angels, and a lot of it now is corporate money. But it's harder and harder to find individuals.
But I suppose those people who do invest in the theatre and form a kind of elite gambling club, really.
That's a good way of putting it, yes. It's very nice if you invest in a hit to be able, when somebody says, oh, I just saw the show, and you say, well, I'm an investor. It's a kind of little, it's very similar to the world of racing and racehorses.
So do you, as the producer, have a huge number of contacts? I mean, would you ring up specific people for specific shows?
Yes, I would. There are some people I wouldn't ask in specific shows because I know they wouldn't like it or they wouldn't, you know.
Mm.
It varies. There are no rules.
But your contacts book is probably one of your most important possessions, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that. It's pretty good, though. my general contacts in the world are pretty good.
So you did all of that very successfully through the 60s. I mean, to name some more of your productions, Son of Oblomov in the 60s with Spike Milligan, Joe Orton's Lute and The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, and of course, O Calcutta.
That was Leonard Roster's first. Great.
Arturo Uy.
Yes, he was fantastic.
That was when we first noticed him, really, wasn't it? But then at the end of that decade, the 60s, you were offered the play Every Producer Dreams Of, which we'll talk about in a minute, but let's pause for another record.
In the 60s, when London was really getting going, I met and became friends with Chris Blackwell, who started the whole reggae thing, and I think it's the only music that I haven't got tired of. I mean, the Beatles at the time I loved, but it's like eating too many chocolates. I just can't hear it anymore. But Marley is different, and I can still hear this.
Bob Marley and Coming In From the Cold. The play that came your way in the 60s, Michael, was Sleuth. Two characters, one set, and it was a thriller. I mean, it's just it was a delight, wasn't it?
It was a dream. But it's funny about that because nobody wanted to be in it. I tried to get every actor you can think of. Laurence Olivier, everyone. I remember talking to Laurence Olivier about it. He said, oh, they won't get it when they'd guess the trick. And there is a trick, it won't work. And of course, I felt that that play would work whether you knew it was a trick or even if you didn't, whatever way you saw it. And it took over a year to find anyone to do it. And I had to kind of talk everyone into being in it and doing it.
Who did you get in the end?
Anthony Quayle. He was very, very good in it.
But of course, Olivier did the film in the end, didn't he?
In the end, Olivier did the film.
Then after that you had a Chorus Line and Annie and Pirates of Penzance all through the 70s. I think at one point you had seven productions running at one time. And then in the 80s you seemed to disappear from the theatrical scene after this I show talked about.
Yeah, that was a terrific blow. And also I became much more interested in film. And then I started up a whole other side of my life, which was with the comic strip, which was a very, in retrospect, smart move because everybody involved in that whole thing has become incredibly successful.
So you were, as they say, where it was at?
Yes.
That's what you like, isn't it?
Well, in a sense, it's always fun to see somebody and think they're good and then cut to 10 years later and everybody else does.
Mm. But you're back very much in the West End now. As we've said, you've had Crazy For You and Fame.
I hope so.
And you're planning, I understand, the first nude musical for years called Voyeurs with a Z.
Yes.
What is it?
I must correct you. It's not the first nude musical. It's not. That makes it sound like everybody's running around like in a nudist camp. It's not that. It's a musical which is set in a New York nightclub. And during the course of this girl's adventures, there are some nude scenes.
It's a lesbian nightclub.
It's a club that caters to everyone, but has a strong lesbian tendency. It's not at all like a Soho strip show or anything like that. There are moments of nudity.
It's interesting, though, nudity in the 90s. You know, in the 60s, we thought it was so dangerous. So we found it uplifting, I suppose. In the 90s, somehow it smacks of kind of sleaze, I suppose. I mean, do we want it? Isn't it a bit depressing?
I don't think this will be at all depressing. And you used a word, sleaze, which isn't applicable to this. This is going to be quite beautiful. Not at all sleazy.
It's going to be a hit, is it? Are you predicting a hit?
I hope so. I do. I think it will be a hit. I think it'll be so unexpected and so unlike what you're implying it might be. It's going to be the complete reverse of that, which is what is going to make it interesting.
Next piece of music.
This is a song from the show. And in this club, the band who are playing there every night in the play are an American female band called Femme de Femme. And this is a song of theirs.
Angels with crooked wings, I got to sign plans on evil things. Dark sides of inner soul. In my dreams, a wicked ball. We are the wild ones. Ooh. We are the wild ones.
Femme to Femme and Sin. So, after it all, Michael, are you a rich man?
No, I'm not. I've been rather bad with money, and I should have had a business manager.
But you've got this wonderful context book, a successful business, a vibrant social life. I would imagine a desert island would be anathema to you.
Correct. I was invited to this very fancy club down in the Caribbean, and the brochure said, you will see no one on the beach. And the minute I got there, I thought, this is not for me. I don't want to see no one on the beach.
Can you cook? Can you look after yourself?
Yes, I'm a good cook. I'd be good at making up the menu and boiling the veggies.
What will you miss most, apart from the company of women, of course?
I think the whole social intercourse, which is what I like. I like the social drive of big cities. I could never live in the country.
There's a wonderful...
I should have picked the song. There's a famous song, which is based 30s Broadway musical. They go to the country and they're walking from the station. They say, I hate this. It's so noisy. The birds, the cows, the mooing. Get me back to Broadway. Get some real noise.
Let's hear about your eighth record, which is quite different from any of the others.
Well... Although he was a horrid person, Wagner, he was, for me, one of the great geniuses ever. And I love The Ring, and I like this aria. It's so sad, it's the end of the gods. And I like this feeling of the end, death, the end of an era.
Part of Brunhilde's final aria from Wagner's Götterdämmerung, sung by Birgit Nielsen, with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Sir George Scholte. If you could only take one of those records, Michael, I wonder which one you'd choose.
Oh, I'd have to have a dance one. I think I'd probably take Coming In From the Cold.
Bob Marley?
Hmm.
And what about your book?
I'm going to take Proust. À la recherche du temps perdu.
Which you've read?
Which I've read three times and like very much. And it gives you a whole other world. It's like suddenly you've got an entire new group of friends, family.
And your luxury?
A bicycle.
What are you going to do on this bicycle? Ride round and round in circles?
Yes. You want to keep healthy, don't you? And you probably couldn't swim in the sea because of all the nasty little things in it, but... could cycle round the circle.
Michael White, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.